Hello, Blogging Heads Nation. It's Heather Rolbert from the National Security Network.
And Daniel Dresner from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy and foreignpolicy.com.
Back together after what we were told is an 8-month hiatus since we did one together. Dan, was it something I said?
You never call, you never write.
Well, I think the other joke is it's even longer than Will and Kate's engagement.
Fair enough, but I would like to think that our relationship will hopefully last even longer than theirs.
Okay, now that we've gone there, I was just saying to you that my way of participating in the royal wedding hoopla was to have breakfast with the former British Foreign Minister David Miliband this morning.
Wow, that's quite impressive. Also impressive that, you know, he was free.
Well, indeed. The funny thing about this was, if you're really into your wonky British political history, as I'm sure some of the commentators will be, he ran for Labour Party leader, right, and in fact was beaten by his own brother. So, you know, not only is he out of government, he's not Labour Party leader, and I kind of imagined throughout this breakfast that there must be a little thought balloon over his head, sort of secretly wishing that instead of sitting at New America taking probing questions from Steve Clemens at 8:45 in the morning, he was wearing tails and standing in some receiving line at Buckingham Palace.
I can think of a very long list of things I want to do rather than taking probing questions from Steve Clemens at 8:30 in the morning at the New America Foundation. So, and in fact, we will encourage our commenters to come up with an entire list of those things.
And Dan will post the best ones on his blog.
Exactly.
Thus getting him into a beef with Steve Clemens on his blog, which will drive up the ratings outrageously for both of them.
Which is much like the royal wedding in that sense, you know. It's all about the ratings.
Right. Well, shifting relentlessly to foreign policy news, there were some gatecrashers at the royal wedding today as Egypt seized the moment to announce an opening of the border crossing with Gaza. And I imagined thousands of Palestinians streaming across the border wearing top hats.
I like that idea. So it's the formal opening of the border. Well, this is part and parcel of a series of initiatives that Egypt has taken, the caretaker government has taken, that have, let's just say, roiled. Oh, let's face it, Israel. I mean, that's really the primary country that's objecting to this. Not just the opening of the border, but also the announcement this week of an alleged unity deal between Fatah and Hamas, not to mention the opening of, or the beginning of opening of relations with Iran.
Well, you know, one of the things that actually I think it's important to look just beyond the Israeli dimension, although we could certainly spend the rest of the hour generating at least more heat, if not light, about that.
Yeah.
But on the one hand, you know, the resurgence of Egypt as a regional player and clearly indicating the desire, even in a transitional government, to be a regional player, you know, number one, there's a split between the Gaza Hamas and the Syria Hamas, and this suggests, I mean, for obvious reasons, the loss of influence by the Syrian Hamas. And second, although, you know, it looks like one thing for Egypt to be reaching out and reestablishing diplomatic ties with Iran, in some other ways, Iran is the loser. The less that Hamas has to rely on Iran because it doesn't have alternative interlocutors.
Right.
Now Hamas is talking. I mean, they have been talking to Turkey and talking to Egypt, but clearly those moderating modalities have proven more useful. Egypt, you know, reemerges as a player, and frankly, as a player that's profoundly more appealing to the Arab world than Iran is. So I think there's a tendency these days to see anything that happens in the Arab Spring, quote unquote, as, oh, this is good for Iran and bad for the West. And I admit this is a significant if we can manage our response, and if we can say Hamas is profoundly repugnant, many of the things it endorses are rightly and profoundly repugnant to us, but if we can handle ourselves in a way that we don't push them back into the arms of Iran, and that we don't hand Iran propaganda victories, and that we don't hand Iran the gift of us being the ones to seem to make it easy not to have a peace process, then in the long run, this is bad for Iran and good for things we believe in.
Okay, a couple of thoughts on this. The first is, I agree with you that I think that there's a tendency to exaggerate what's actually going on the ground. That, you know, for example, Egypt opening up diplomatic relations with Iran, I agree with you. This is just, you know, Egypt actually doing something relatively smart, which is trying to, you know, reassert itself as the center of the Arab world. And, you know, again, I think the Egyptians have been reasonable in terms of responding to saying, look, just because we're opening up in a, you know, a relationship with them doesn't mean we're suddenly going to become best buddies. In some ways, this is a competition for influence, and I agree with you. There's a lot of ways in which the Egyptian alternative looks much more appealing than the Iranian one. I think my question is, again, this does in some ways come back to Israel, because presumably one of the big questions will be, how is Israel going to respond to this? And I can't help but thinking that given the current government, the two-word response is not well. You know, to what extent do you think Israel will actually respond in such a way that exacerbates the tensions that are going to be increasing inevitably between Israel and Egypt?
Well, look, I mean, the place you have to start is that this is genuinely and seriously unnerving for the Israeli public, yeah. And you've got to take that really seriously. Mm-hmm. Because of the presumption that, you know, frankly, there's already enough problems with Hamas rockets and so on, and that this will make it easier for Hamas to get rockets,
right.
And to terrorize portions of the Israeli population. That, you know, the relationship between Israel and Egypt was a cornerstone of Israel's approach. As someone also said, so was the enmity between Israel and Syria. That was a very dependable enmity, and in some ways, those were two cornerstones of how any Israeli government of any political stripe knew it could approach its region, and both of those are gone. And so it's really important to take that seriously and legitimately as sort of the starting point for thinking about Israel. Then, having said that, you also do have this government that is dependent for its survival on some very right-wing elements that are, you know, frankly, not at all interested in seeing legitimate democratic aspirations of Palestinians recognized, that don't see that as a path to peace for Israel, and therefore are going to see this only, you know, that don't have the long-term view on it that you and I have enunciated. And so therefore, you know, for them, from a political survival point of view, the pressure is going to be to have a very, very negative response. And then I think not only in Israel, but then to press the U.S.,
right.
to have a similarly negative response. And as people may know, the U.S. Congress has passed a series of laws over the years that actually make it against U.S. law to aid government entities that include Hamas. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're facing in Washington as a result of this week's events some real challenges in terms of how do we maintain our leverage with the Palestinians. And that's going to be, you know, that's going to feed into a domestic political food fight here around how whether American politicians can have kind of savvy and pragmatic responses to political Islam or not. And, you know, being as we're in the middle already of 2012 primary season,
Heather, I mean, isn't the obvious
pessimistic.
I would say, isn't the obvious answer to that no? I mean, there's just no, you know, I mean, think about the last year's worth of debate in Washington and, you know, during the midterms about the role that political Islam plays. Is it really at all possible that there's actually going to be any kind of sane level of debate on this?
Well, you're the realist and I'm the optimist, right? But
okay.
You actually, the fact that you have a number of really sane, I mean, okay, no, let me take that back. In the context of the Arab Spring, you had people like Bill Kristol saying, we have to talk to the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yes, that's true.
So you actually, you know, I'm hopeful that the scope of these events are so large. Mm-hmm. And both the geopolitical implications for the U.S. and our ability to finally, you know, move beyond some of the old habits and alliances and limits of thinking that have held us back in this part of the world. Not to mention also if you actually care about human freedom and democratic development, either for idealistic reasons or because you think they produce certain political outcomes that you like. I'm really hopeful that those things together will bring enough strange bedfellows out of the woodwork, if I can string together any more cliches than that, and mitigate, you know, what I think there's the potential for an extremely negative reaction that's going to feel really good here, and it's going to feel really good because Hamas has done revolting things, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to have any illusions. I don't want to appear to have any illusions otherwise. But it's in fact not going to, you know, cutting off aid to the Palestinian Authority is going to make it easier for Hamas to do more bad things, and it's going to make it easier for Iran to find and Hezbollah to find more adherents in the region. It's going to make it easier for the Muslim Brotherhood to win support in Egypt, and people just need to be clear-eyed that that's the chain of causality we're facing.
Well, one of the other questions I had about this, I mean, part of the reason you're seeing this deal, I mean, first of all, the fact that Egypt is now supporting it rather than was driving a wedge between the two of them, which was the case under the Mubarak government. But, you know, this is part and parcel of this sort of Abbas Salam Fayyad strategy of actually creating a Palestinian state, regardless of what Israel wants, to the point where it actually achieves recognition in the UN General Assembly and, you know, across a whole welter of countries. And what I think I find surprising about this is in some ways how almost hogtied Israel seems to be in response to this. They almost seem gobsmacked there that this is actually being pursued as a strategy. But furthermore, I don't think they have anything, you know, remotely approaching a viable response, except to constantly point out that Hamas would now be part of the unity government. So I guess my two questions is, first, how long do you think this Hamas, that's a great, oh, we got to use that from now on. How long do you think this Hamas coalition of Fatah and Hamas will last? And also, do you think Israel can come up with a response that, you know, maintains a response that doesn't exacerbate problems, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it?
I would hesitate to guess how long the coalition will last. Mm-hmm. What I know is it cannot appear to be Israel or the West that brings it down. Mm-hmm. Let me unpack why that is. And it's worth sort of pausing a minute over why this is happening right now.
Right.
And if you talk to Palestinians, if you talk to people who've spent much time in either the West Bank or Gaza lately, if you look at public opinion, you see a lot of Palestinians soul-searching about, wait a minute, if the Egyptians and the Tunisians and even the Yemenis,
yeah,
and now the Syrians,
and the Syrian
can stand up and demand democracy for themselves, why not us?
Right.
So,
and there have been protests. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, there have been protests. And it's been very clear to both Hamas and Fatah for a long time that the public in both the West Bank and Gaza wants a unity government. And it's also been clear, and this goes to the second part of your question, that there's a swath of the Israeli political spectrum that sees the long-term solution to the problem as permanently separating the West Bank and Gaza and driving them apart and really turning them into two separate political entities. And continuing a situation in which, well, you know, maybe they deal with the West Bank, but they can't be expected to deal with Gaza. Mm. So this really, it represents the two political entities being forced somewhere because of popular demands and because of what's happening elsewhere in the Arab world. So because of that, it's a crazy idea for anyone outside to think it'd be a good idea to try to break it up. Now, it may very well not stand up on its own. It's going to face some major challenges, but for God's sake, and we really need to learn the lesson of the last time that we tried to interfere in Palestinian politics by scheduling an election, and that's how we got this Hamas government, people need to remember.
Yeah.
We really need to understand that we cannot have anything to do with that. It's got to stand or fall on its own.
I mean, I guess the other question then becomes, is what is this new Egypt going to look like in terms of a foreign policy actor? You've painted, as you said, a relatively optimistic picture where Egypt reasserts its sort of centrality, you know, across the Middle East. This also gives, you know, obvious rise to the question of, you know, how is Egypt going to view its relations with the United States, you know, or Israel for that matter? I mean, there was a poll that Pew just came out with, which I think contained a few surprises in it, one of which was there is still profound Egyptian hostility to the United States, even after what happened in January. And, you know, this does, you know, raise some troubling questions about what the U.S. strategic position will be vis-a-vis the rest of the Middle East.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's really important to underline that Egyptians actually don't really perceive that the U.S. played a very helpful role
right.
in January. And so whatever Americans may think about it, that's, you know, Egyptians don't perceive that the U.S. was particularly helpful to them. They perceive some individuals. I think Barack Obama as a person still gets relatively high marks.
That's
but,
correct, yeah.
There's a wonderful sort of story making the rounds about a very high-ranking American official going to Egypt and meeting with some of the younger democracy activists and asking them what they wanted. And they said, first, we want an apology for you propping Mubarak up for all these years. Mm-hmm. Second, we want you to forgive our debt because that's Mubarak's debt and it's a shame to us. And third, then we want you to go away and let us work this out for ourselves. So, you know, there's a lot of talk back and forth in Washington about, oh, what kind of aid package for Egypt? You know, there's a real way that to fix things, one of the things we need to think about is as much a respect package as an aid package.
Mm-hmm.
The other sort of response to your question I would make is whoever the new president of Egypt is, however things shake out, you know, clearly everybody in Egypt wants Egypt to have a regionally central place that's appropriate to its historical status.
Right.
So then the question for the U.S. and also for Israel is, we know that's going to be their desire. How are we going to work with that? Are there ways we can try to engage them constructively? Are there ways we can avoid needlessly antagonizing them? Which, again, this response to how we respond to opening the border with Gaza is going to be a very challenging early test of that. So this is being driven by internal dynamics that the U.S. doesn't control, but we're going to have important opportunities to either indicate to the Egyptians that we want to work constructively with them if they want to work constructively or not, or we can indicate to them, frankly, that we don't understand that the rules have changed. And, you know, as you say, there's a lot of reason for worry about that.
Right. I mean, you know, there was in the same Pew poll, you have a majority of Egyptians saying they want to annul the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. Now, I actually don't think that's going to translate in any concrete policy moves. I think, you know, across the board, anyone who gets elected Egypt's president, the last thing they want to do is rupture that peace deal. But still, you know, there are genuine... You've got a government that actually for the first time can claim in quite some time, look, we're just responding to what the public wants.
Yeah, and this is why... I mean, well, there's two things. One is that if you look at the full scope of things in that poll, you know, not everything is so negative. And, you know, what Amr Moussa came out and said the other day... Yeah. Was that he didn't necessarily regard the peace treaty as the foundation for Egypt's relationship with Israel, which, you know, of course, freaked out everyone in the West, yeah. But that he did regard some of the more subsequent agreements as the base. So he, you know, he said, look, there are things that form the basis of our relationship with Israel, just not necessarily that peace treaty. And so the trick for Western diplomacy, and this is going to be incredibly difficult because of the political situation in the U.S., the political situation in Israel, and, again, Israeli anxiety, which is not illegitimate, but... To help the Egyptian body politic come to a sense of a relationship with Israel that's not founded, that's not being forced down their throat.
Right.
And that's not founded on something illegitimate that Mubarak did, but that's founded on a legitimate sense of Egypt's own interest. And to the extent, you know, that's going to require some forbearance by the U.S. and Israel as the Egyptians come to that themselves. And you know, forbearance is not something we're real good at.
Well, speaking of which, that gives rise to our next point, which is that, you know, this past week there was a reshuffling, I think would be the best word to use, of Obama's national security team. So we now have Bob Gates being replaced by CIA head Leon Panetta. Panetta is being replaced at the CIA by CENTCOM commander David Petraeus. Ryan Crocker is being sent back to Afghanistan as the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador. And, oh, God help me, who's replacing Petraeus? I can't remember the name.
General Allen.
Thank you, General Allen. I apologize to General Allen. But anyway, so, you know, this has prompted a whole flurry of discussions about what exactly this means. I'm just curious about your take about all this first.
I said to somebody that I felt, actually, I've said this to several reporters and none of them have chosen to use it. It's funny.
Well, you know what? This is why we have blogging heads. So just
speak to the
people directly.
Yes. That I felt like this was like finding the Rosetta Stone or digging up the missing link in the anthropological, archaeological history of how President Obama thinks about high-level appointments, and that all of these folks in this tranche, these are men who are... who all rose up incredibly successfully within an organization, so they're kind of classic organization men in some way, and were good at subverting or rewriting the rules of some key element of the institution that they owe their success to at the same time.
Huh.
So, and if you think about, like, to me, this just really says to me, this gives me a real blueprint for what it is that Obama most prizes. And so, you know, I said... Something else I said to a reporter was that the left will be unhappy because there won't be systemic change in any of these places.
No, I mean,
and the right will be unhappy because there will be what the right perceives as systemic change at these places. And that's kind of another thing to me that's sort of the classic hallmark of a Barack Obama appointment.
Interesting. I mean, I agree with you that I think the buzzword about all this has been continuity. I would add two other elements to this. The first is that the other thing to think about is that Obama clearly is, you know, the other thing he's got to think about is how do you get these people confirmed by Congress? And one of the advantages of the people he's picked is they've already been confirmed by Congress for other positions. And so, let's face it, Panetta is going to get confirmed, and God knows Petraeus is going to get confirmed. Actually, with the Petraeus nomination, I just want to see if anyone actually asks him a critical question, because that'll be a lot of fun to watch. Because I think, you know, he's sort of, you know, the untouchable at this point. The two things I keep wondering, though, are as follows. The first is, when Panetta's announcement was made, the first guy I thought of was Cap Weinberger. Because Weinberger is the last guy who used to be the OMB head, the Office of Management and Budget head, and then became Secretary of Defense. And at the time, everyone thought, Weinberger was known as Cap the Knife when he was at OMB because he was such an ardent budget cutter. He then goes.
Dan, our age is showing.
Yes, I know. I apologize. Heather, you don't know this, because you were in grade school at the time, but I remember this. and he was known as Cap the Knife. And then there was shock and surprise when he went became the Secretary of Defense, because rather than cutting the Defense Department budget, he became, possibly the most successful, booster of the Defense Department budget in the history of the United States. So my first concern is that, there's a lot of talk about how Panetta is going to DOD because he's going to be a budget cutter, and everyone recognizes that the budget has to be pared. But I do wonder what is the likelihood or possibility that he goes native by being there. Go ahead, and then I'll ask the next one. Yeah,
so I think that is a challenge for anybody that you put in the... I mean, I can't think of anyone who was ever mentioned for the position that you wouldn't have asked that exact same question about when he or she was named.
Yeah.
And I also think that Gates has... I mean, Gates has attempted to bake the cake on this in a very interesting way.
Yeah.
That on the one hand, Gates has tried to prepare the way for an environment in which, frankly... growth stops vastly outpacing the rate of inflation, that defense stops being the fastest growing aspect of the discretionary budget.
No, he said literally the gusher has been turned off and it'll be off for quite some time.
But he's also done a really masterful job of presenting the situation such that many people think that the defense budget is being cut this year or is being cut next year, and it's actually not. The rate of increase is being cut.
That's a fair point.
But Gates has really done a great job of baking the cake on that. So Panetta, on the one hand, Gates has done some of the hard work for him. I think getting to the next stage where you're actually doing more than... since we saw that, Paul Ryan wasn't willing to do anything more than Gates did. The political will outside the Defense Department is at least as limited as the political will inside the Defense Department. And here, I think the reason for optimism about Panetta is that you have to have someone who is sort of wise to the ways of how Congress tries to play with defense spending, and how every year, for example, the Pentagon sends to Congress what it wants in terms of a pay raise for troops, and Congress increases that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's now a move afoot on the Hill, on the House side, to try one more time to resuscitate the alternate engine for the F-35.
Mm-hmm.
And, how many times does the Secretary of Defense have to tell you he doesn't want it before it goes away? So if you have a Secretary of Defense who isn't wise to that and isn't respected on the Hill, then you have no chance. And so I think...
Well, no, I agree with you there. I mean, in that sense...
It's a start,
yes,
is how I
No, Panetta is definitely respected on the Hill. And, before he goes away, I just want to express my complete and total man crush on Bob Gates. I was a huge fan of Gates when he was appointed to replace Donald Rumsfeld. I thought he... this is one of those rare times where I said something in the beginning and it turned out I was right, which is that I thought he was...
Do we have tape on that?
I have a blog post on it where I said Gates is the perfect, guy to replace Rumsfeld at DOD because, he's a grown-up. And he'll run the building and he'll actually be able to presumably do what, affect what he wants. So, yes, I look back at my blog post on Bob Gates. I've been a big fan of Bob Gates for quite some time. And it's worth remembering that Gates, for a while, was considered damaged goods. Again, this shows my age. You, of course, were in kindergarten when this happened. But, Gates, if you remember, when he first was sent to CIA in the first Bush administration, he barely squeaked through the confirmation process because he was tarnished by Iran-Contra or something. So it was kind of thought that he wasn't, going to be Senate confirmable again. But as it turns out, I think he walks away as one of those few sort of foreign policy heavyweights that it's admired on both sides of the aisle, I would say.
Yeah, there's actually a whole separate blogging heads to be done sometime about the sort of fascinating reversals of fortunes of people from the 80s. The
That's
one I think
point,
of
yeah.
is Tom Pickering, who's now at this point beloved of realists and leftists alike everywhere for his stands on Afghanistan, Iran, and other issues. But, of course, those of us who are old enough to remember the 80s remember a lot of protests directed at him for his connections with U.S. policy in Central America. And if you had asked me as a high school student in the 80s, would I ever be a huge fan, would I ever describe Tom Pickering that way, I'd be very surprised to be seeing my adult self. But he's undeniable. He does fabulous work. And so it's there's a really interesting kind of deeper thing to be said about people who are of their times in ways that are good and bad and also manage to transcend them, and people who are just of their times. Because we're all of our time, or almost all of, you know, very few of us are Martin Luther King, right?
So
the best we can hope for is that sort of in-between being wrong, because we're of our times, we can occasionally manage to be transcendent, and it's interesting to look back and see sort of who did that.
It's true. At some point, I would agree that we should do that, Blogging Heads, but only if we both dress up in 80s... you know, back in our, in what we look like during the 80s, which, you know.
Okay, that's a good one. Do you think that we'll get that one on the New York Times website?
Oh, that would so go on the website, you know. That and you know, all we have to do is have some Depeche Mode in the background, and we're gold. The other thing I did want to ask you about the reshuffle was something that Fred Kaplan wrote in Slate about, which is he was generally praiseworthy of the reshuffling, but one of his arguments was that the reason Obama didn't bring anyone new in or promote, you know, really anyone, you know, from the middle ranks up, is that he basically argued that there is a true lack of star strength, I think was the way he put it, in, you know, in on both sides, I think, but in this case, because it's a Democratic administration among Democrats, of sort of major foreign policy heavyweights, that he apparently asked, you know, friends, columnists, et cetera, you know, who would you replace Bob Gates with that would be, you know, Senate confirmable and still be able to do the job, and there weren't, you know, no one could really offer that many answers. And it actually reminded me of something that, correct me if I'm wrong, you wrote in the Washington Monthly about 10 years ago, post 9/11, about the lack of Democratic bench strength on national security affairs. So
I wrote it 10 years ago, and it was true 10 years ago. When it comes to sort of who would be the next Secretary of Defense, it's actually crap.
Okay.
So I will now name off some people.
There you go.
Who, all of whom, you know, if you believe the Washington rumor mill, were actively considered.
Okay.
And you can have whatever opinions of them you have, but like the idea that there's a lack of intellectual seriousness and or a lack of firepower just is crap.
I think it was that plus the sort of political savviness of dealing with the Hill, which, to be fair,
okay,
is an additional skill.
Okay, hold on. All right, so my first one is Senator Jack Reed.
Okay.
Very widely respected, former Marine, would have easily been confirmed, respected for his policy smarts, his military service. I mean, you know, I want to see Jack Reed do more things.
I always get leery of members of Congress than, you know, I mean, Panetta's an exception.
Hey, I didn't say that Dan Dresner has to like them. That wasn't one of Kaplan's
All right, look, I'll just respond with two words, which again dates us, Les Aspin.
Uh-huh, yeah, but House of Representatives.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, so Jack Reed is one.
All right.
John Hamray, who's the head of CSIS, and admittedly he's only a star inside the Beltway, but he is a bona fide, major, beloved bipartisan star inside the Beltway, former Deputy Secretary of Defense.
Okay.
Nobody would have voted against him, and he's a major heavyweight.
I'm assuming all these people can produce valid American birth certificates, by the way. Just go on.
I've never asked. Michelle Flournoy, rising star, currently the number three official at the Pentagon, Democratic woman, major, major policy intellectual credentials. Also, by the way, rumored to have been the military's preferred candidate.
This was, I don't know.
Somewhat counterintuitively.
Yeah, no. Did you read Spencer Ackerman's portrayal, you know, story about her here in the Washingtonian? I was actually somewhat surprised she wasn't the one promoted, and I was wondering. You know,
I'll get to that in a minute. But anyway, but Michelle, I mean,
no, I'm a big fan of Flournoy, so I'm with you on
serious.
That. Yeah.
You know, I never took the Hillary Clinton thing very seriously, but she's highly credible. She would have been confirmed. You can't say she doesn't have star power
or balls.
I myself find that a tedious
Sorry.
Metaphor to use,
yeah,
but if you need to use that
no,
one,
no, no, no,
yes.
she's got the gravitas. Go ahead.
Yes, she does. And then, you know, there's Richard Danzig, who's another, you know, former Secretary of the Navy, Obama advisor on the campaign, much beloved by people who know and like him, you know, had been an early favorite for the job. There's Larry Corbett Cap, similarly much beloved by many people, Reagan-era defense appointee.
Yeah.
I could go on and on.
Yeah,
so,
fair
you know,
point.
This idea that, this, I mean, Petraeus, I mean, you know, we forgot to mention Petraeus, oh, by the way. who I don't think was ever a serious candidate, but, you know, is a serious person with a lot of gravitas.
Oh, but Petraeus couldn't have actually become Secretary of Defense. I mean, that's...
Sure he could. All he has to do is retire.
Can you actually then become Secretary of Defense immediately after you retire?
I don't believe the Constitution says there's a waiting period, but you're the scholar of those sorts of things.
I'm not sure about the Constitution, but there is kind of a norm. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong on this.
Right. So I think what you are seeing...
Yeah.
is a very clear Obama preference to appoint from within.
Right.
You know, I mean, and I think most of the senior level, I'm actually right now, I'm trying to think of a senior level national security position that's been filled from outside. You know, Donilon was promoted up.
Right.
White House legal advisor, you know, Bob Bennett's the exception that proves the rule, right? He came in from outside. Mm-hmm. Daley came in from outside.
And Jim Jones is, by the way, also an exception because he was an outsider when he was brought in and didn't last long.
Yeah. Yeah, but then the national security positions, I mean, everybody's just been promoted. But you also haven't, I mean, I think Donilon's the one exception of a deputy moving into a number one slot, and that's kind of not the norm. Mm-hmm. So as much as I'm a huge fan of Michelle's, I wasn't, and I hope they move Michelle. I want to see Michelle in a cabinet post in the next term. I just don't think it'll be defense.
Really? Why do you say that? I mean,
because it's just not the norm to move people. Like, I can't think when somebody got moved from sort of number two or three to number one.
Bill Perry.
Well, but that's because of Les Aspin.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, no, it wasn't that. Wait.
If Les Aspin is the exception that proves every rule.
And we shall hereby call that the Aspin exception. No, this is a genuine concern. I don't know Flournoy at all, and she's someone who I've heard nothing but good things about. And I'm going to compare to someone. I don't want you to take this as casting aspersions. My one concern about Flournoy is that to what extent is she like Paul Wolfowitz, in that Wolfowitz also – I know. But that Wolfowitz also had – if you take a look at his resume, had a series of relatively impressive appointments, but was not necessarily thought of as an administrator. That was always the knock against him. And so that was always the thought that, you know, would prevent him from having a full cabinet position. And let's face it, running the Pentagon is an administrative position. I mean, does she have that sort of bona fide?
Right. Well, let's, first of all, I should disclaimer here, I do know Michelle personally. Right. And I can assure you that she's no Paul Wolfowitz.
Yes, obviously. Okay,
second, I think, I mean, actually, the part of the Pentagon that she runs is actually regarded by everybody I know as sort of the best place in the national security bureaucracy to work.
Okay. All right.
That she's viewed by everyone I know who works for her, or frankly people who don't work for her, as one of the best bosses, if not the best boss.
Okay. See, this is good to know. All right. I'm glad.
So you know, I would vouch strongly for her on that basis alone.
So I mean, do you think that in general? I mean, in some ways, this has always been a concern I've had about the sort of foreign policy establishment, for lack of a better way of putting it. I like having the parties interchange, because I want to think that whoever are going to be the cabinet secretaries for the Democratic president after Obama, they're getting their seasoning this time around. A lot of the names that you just said are people that are currently out of government. So what I want to know is, do you think that the bench strength now of Democrats is much better, you know, particularly for those people who are now working within the Obama administration, than it was when you wrote that article? And the fact that you paused is interesting.
Well, there's two different lines of argument that I would take about that. I mean, because the reason I paused, actually, is that you're asking me to comment in a sort of live media format about many of my close friends and acquaintances and people that I've known for 20 years.
Fair enough.
So I want to say, first of all, I don't want to pretend to any degree of neutrality about these people.
Okay.
So then I want to back off. First, I want to back off and say something that I am much that is a neutral observation, and that is that I wrote that article before the beginning of the Iraq War.
Right.
One of the things that the Iraq War did was create a whole new generation of national security progressives, so that you have a lot of people who are frankly younger than I am, people who are in their 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. Since we've so thoroughly outed our intimate familiarity with the 80s. But there's people who are in their 20s and 30s, many of whom are military veterans, or people who worked overseas and who have a really good understanding of what the U.S. was doing wrong on the ground during the Bush administration, and that it's actually that drove them to an interest in national security policy and to careers in national security policy and to being Democrats rather than Republicans or being apolitical.
Yeah.
So I look at, you know, the generation of people that are younger than me, the generation of people that I get to hire and work with here at the National Security Network, and we have a great, I mean, it's actually kind of crazy. We're producing too many national security and Middle East experts, and I wish we were producing a few more experts.
Not enough political economy China guys, yeah.
Yeah, and I wish we were producing, frankly, my concern is there's a lot of really smart econ China people.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of really smart political strategy, military strategy people, and there's almost no interaction between the two except crazy people who think that, you know, China is building an army of carriers.
Right.
So that's where I see a missing link, and I wish a few more people still cared about, you know, Russia, my old back when I was an area expert, that was my area of expertise, which really dates me. But I wish a few more people cared about that. But I think we have a fabulous bench of people in their 20s and 30s who are, you know, getting their seasoning as in miserable staff assistant jobs and Hill jobs and so on.
Okay, I'll turn the tables on you. I mean, how would you assess the Republicans at this point? I mean, because the problem they have, of course, is that they're out of power. But do you think there were enough particularly, you know, up-and-comers serving, let's say, the second term of the Bush administration so that, you know, if, you know, a Republican wins in 2012, which is unlikely, but if one wins in 2016, which is much more likely, they will have the sufficient bench strength?
Well, it's an interesting, above all, a sociological question, because the guys I know, you know, people like Jamie Fly, mm-hmm. Who runs Bill Kristol's Foreign Policy Initiative. Yeah. I mean, Jamie's a really smart guy, mm-hmm. very young guy. He's going to be around for a long time. Other people like that, some of the younger folks that are now working for Senator McCain,
right.
for example. Somebody like Corey Shockey, who's our generation.
Or Dan Twining.
Or Dan Twining, yeah. I mean, in general, I don't worry about Republicans because as I said sociologically 10 years ago, people who are sort of driven to become Republicans tend to be concerned about security issues, so I don't really worry about their recruitment base
right.
so much. It's an interesting question given the generalized level of craziness around so much Republican politics that you know, the people I just named off, they're not spending their time thinking about Obama's birth certificate,
right.
and they're not big Michelle Bachmann fans.
Or Donald
and so
Trump.
I don't know what that's doing to a young person sitting in grad school and what that person thinks about wanting to go and work for a Republican candidate versus wanting to go into the private sector and work on international affairs in the private sector where, you know, the crazy person quotient is perhaps a little lower and the money's better.
Well, I mean, no, you're right, and this is an interesting thing. You know, the crazy person of the moment is Donald Trump, and, you know, forget the birth certificate nonsense. Have you actually seen what he said about his foreign policy views? I'd say, as a Republican, this is the dumbest fucking stuff I have ever seen. This guy seriously seems to think that foreign affairs operates roughly along par with a real estate deal. And I really,
to which I say, if only.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that would be nice. It would be nice. I mean, you know, I'm actually decent in negotiating real estate. You know, international relations, an entirely different universe. And it really scares the crap out of me that this guy is actually enough of a blowhard to think that all, you know, you really need to do to, you know, get a better deal out of China or get a better deal out of OPEC is just put the right messenger in the room. Which,
yeah. Well, I think it's actually worse than him being that much of a blowhard.
Yeah.
It's that there's a bipartisan failure to give Americans a construct in which we can understand how complex
yeah.
21st century international affairs are. And because there's that bipartisan failure, there's room out there for a message about how it's just like a real estate deal. And
right.
so, you know, he's found a hole and he's exploiting it. And that, I mean, you know, yes, he's a horrifying figure. But we got to face up to some shared responsibility for, and you see this, I mean, on a whole range of issues, where the public, you know, sort of actually hunts for a more complex, nuanced view of the universe, doesn't really get any support from the media for that nuanced view, and then sort of gets beaten back into these really stupid views.
Well, this might be where you and I disagree. I don't think the public actually is hungry for a more sophisticated, nuanced view of foreign affairs. And this is not because, by the way, the public wants a simple thing. It's because the public doesn't care. The American public is profoundly disinterested
in
international
affairs. But, you know, when you assert
that,
I, you know, it doesn't care on one level
yeah.
in that it doesn't care. You're a person, you know, sort of my cousins in Wisconsin.
Right.
My cousins in Wisconsin care a lot more about, you know,
the royal
corn
wedding.
Prices, whether there's more trucking contracts, are their kids' schools any good?
Yeah.
You know, are they going to get flu this winter?
As well they should, I would add.
Right?
This is not a pejorative judgment. That
yes,
is how most
but
Americans
I,
should
but
think about it.
Given space within that,
yeah.
or having explained that, you know, corn prices have something to do with corn prices, other places have something to do
right.
with demand other places, they care about that.
Yeah.
It's just they don't care about it the way you and I do, which is fine because they're not getting money and they're not getting the chance to be on video from caring about it.
Right, absolutely. No, as I said, I really don't – I'm not damning the American people by not caring all that much about this. It is perfectly rational for them not to care that much about it. The problem is that every once in a while the issues present themselves, as when you have high corn prices or when you have high gas prices. And then the problem is that it is fantastically difficult for a foreign policy leader to try to explain what is in fact the sort of complexities involved with trying to connect what's going on in the global political economy to the gas pump. And so as a result, I agree with you, that's an opportunity for someone like Donald Trump to say, oh, all we got to do is strike a better bargain. But I think the problem is structural. I don't think it's a failure of explanation, I guess would be the way to put it.
Well, here's the thing. If it's a structural problem, then we're sort of dead as a society. If it's not a problem that's amenable to fixing in some way, because things are only going to get more complex. And, you know, I took one of these wonderful junkets that one occasionally gets the opportunity to do United Arab Emirates a couple weeks back.
Ooh,
and
nice.
It was funded by the government, took it very seriously, introduced us to a lot of very high-powered people, including the people who run their $15 billion investment funds. And, you know, sort of having these conversations and talking and thinking about, I mean, that's a political system I would never consider living under. You couldn't pay me enough to live in a system where foreigners have no rights, where, you know, the citizenry has very few rights, frankly. But someone in the room said, well, you know, when we were commenting on the difficulty that the U.S. experiences in making infrastructure investments, someone said, well, you know, this political system does have its advantages. And, and that's repugnant to me, but it's also true. And if we can't figure out a way to explain to the citizenry why you need infrastructure investments, why you need a foreign policy that's more complicated than real estate deals, why you have to talk to people you don't like, and again, to make that stick in the face of blowhards like Donald Trump, then we are dead as a society. And that's not a partisan comment. It's just a reality. So,
okay, I will here.
I hope you're wrong.
Well, let me put it this way. I will actually flip here and be more optimistic than you on this in the following sense. As much as Trump has captured a whole lot of headlines and, you know, some modest public opinion support, I mean, this is a flower that's going to wilt very quickly. The fact is, I do think there is a segment of the American population, just like there's a segment...
I think you meant to say it will wilt faster than his toupee.
Ooh, I like that. That's good. That's good. There is a segment of the American population, just like, by the way, there is a segment of the French population, of the Chinese population. This is not hardly a U.S.-centric phenomenon. There are people that, you know, are just generally angry at the world. They feel like they're getting a raw deal somehow, and therefore are perfectly willing to annoy anyone who they think is going to talk tough. And as a result, Trump is filling that gap now in a way that Sarah Palin was filling, you know, a year ago at this time. The nice thing is that that is a minority in the American populace, just as it's a minority in most other places in the world. So I think in some ways, you know, Trump has got outsized attention now because, you know, if you get 20% support in a GOP poll, that actually makes you the front runner, which is not a testament to the strength of Trump, but rather a testament to the incredible weakness of the rest of the field. But as you eventually get, you know, see coalescing around some other viable grown-up challenger, you know, Trump's going to fade, and he's going to fade badly because his record's a disaster. But even someone like Michelle Bachmann or Sarah Palin, whoever fills the crazy time in the primary, I think will not actually do terribly well. But so I do think the problem is structural. I also don't think the problem is terribly serious. And that, you know, probably the best time for this to be done is going to be during the general election as opposed to the primaries. The primaries are silly season because it's just easy to capture attention that way.
Moving to lift the intellectual tone of this conversation.
Exactly, yeah.
You threw out on your blog an interesting challenge to readers,
right.
which I think we should spend a few minutes having fun because it involves lists and everybody loves lists.
Well, all right. So to put it in context, this was a playoff of Ryan Liz's 9,000-word New Yorker essay on, you know, what Obama's grand strategy was in the wake of the Middle Eastern revolutions. And, you know, I had a substantive post on it, but there was something in the beginning of it that I found very interesting, which was that, you know, Liza talks about Obama's, you know, initial foreign policy education when he was a senator, and that, you know, he didn't really know that much, and that so he started reading books by Fareed Zakaria, which is fine, and then Tom Friedman. And, you know, saying that you're reading among foreign policy cognoscenti like you or me, saying that you started getting your foreign policy education by reading Tom Friedman is like saying you started getting your legal education by reading John Grisham novels. It's kind of a de classe thing to do. And it's, you know, the Friedman books are very often derided, in sort of among people in the know in terms of foreign policy and international economics. But that said, you know, if you think about it, I sort of had a second thought. I mean, the first thought is a chuckle. It's like, oh, Barack, really, you started with Friedman. But the second thought is that if you think about it, most politicians, and as we're moving in towards a primary season, it's worth pointing this out, most politicians that, you know, either just get elected to the Senate or are thinking about running for president primarily make their bones by caring about domestic policy. And again, as we said, as well they should, because that's primarily what the American people care about. So the question then becomes, if you want to educate a politician on the ways, you know, the ways of international affairs, the ways of world politics, and you're dealing with someone who is fundamentally not necessarily going to be willing to read all of Thucydides or read any kind of weighty academic tome on this matter, what do you have them read? And by that context, you at least understand why people sometimes turn to Tom Friedman, because he is relatively, you know, extremely accessible. You know, he meets, you know, God knows how many leaders. You know, it's a nice little sort of name-dropping exercise if you read his books. But I do still think we can do better. And so the challenge I laid out to my readers was, what would be the three books you would recommend that an aspiring either presidential candidate or junior senator should read to understand American foreign policy, but with the understanding that they actually have to read the books? In other words, that you can't just throw them to anything and of course they will read it. They've actually got to be interested in the books. Yeah. So, you know, you throw them, you know, Waltz's Theory of International Politics or you know, some other similarly abstruse, you know, book, they're not going to read that. So based on that, it's been interesting to see the responses in the comments.
Right. Well, I have a book and three principles for you in response to this challenge.
Fair enough.
And the book is a slim volume, so it fits the short and written in layperson's language.
Good.
Criteria that you laid down, which I actually just read to review for Democracy, which is forthcoming. And it's called Unwarranted Influence. It's by a journalist named James Ledbetter, and it is a sort of cultural history of Eisenhower's military-industrial complex speech.
Oh.
And it's a good read on the merits, and of course I loved it as a former speechwriter, but it really, it takes a great sort of history of ideas approach to both where the idea of the military-industrial complex, where the threads of it came from and how they came together in Eisenhower's speech, and how it was then used, misused, reused, appropriated after Eisenhower gave the speech. And the thing that makes it not merely a recent book read by me, but something that's also, I think, useful for decision makers, is that it tracks quite a bit sort of how Eisenhower's thought process, decision process, who he was influenced by, who his speechwriters were influenced by, how he related to them, and how they related to events of the time, which I think is a useful model for anybody sort of walking into the cauldron that is Washington to think about, and to sort of feel, again, how you can be utterly of your moment and yet, you know, have opportunities to expose yourselves to things that go somewhat beyond your moment at the same time. So that's just a good book that's out now that I would add to somebody's shelf and that I haven't seen mentioned in that context, so I thought I'd give it some play. My principles, in addition to that, are, number one, make sure that you're reading things from other perspectives and that there's, you know, people like me and institutions like mine, we do such a good job of churning stuff out all the time. So make sure you're reading analysis of policy issues that come from other countries. I like to read a couple of blogs from other countries or, you know, other histories of things. Also, be sure to read people you're disagreeing with. I think everybody should read something by Henry Kissinger, for example. I wish everybody had to read at least a little Marx at some point in their life, not because I think everyone should agree with Marx, but I think it's a useful thing. One of the things I read in the last couple of years that's really been most searing to me in terms of how I think about international affairs was actually Nicholson Baker's book about World War II. Because, you know, he, and I've forgotten the title of the book, but he basically makes the case that the Allied activity in World War II was immoral. And I don't agree with that, but the evidence he marshals about how a combination of racism, cupidity, indifference, and bad policymaking allowed Hitler to marshal the forces to do what he did, which then we had to respond to militarily in a way that also killed a lot of people, is very, very compelling and very searing. And it actually, although this wasn't so much Baker's intent, you know, he really wrote it, I gather, kind of as an anti-war screed, but it really comes off as a plea for much better, smarter, earlier diplomacy.
Interesting.
I read it actually, I mean, I read it because I was asked to review it. Or no, actually, I read it because I was supposed to do a Blogging Heads with him, and then he really pulled back his PR after he got savagely criticized for it in Britain. And again, I don't buy the core argument, but it was a really, really, like, wrestling with it was a very good experience for me. So that everybody should be doing that. Second, read about things that have gone wrong.
Yes.
So something like Fiasco, or some of the other very good books. What's the full title of Rajiv Chandrasekhar's Emerald City book?
Imperial Life in the Emerald City.
Yes. So read about recent catastrophes. I think that's really important. And lastly, read across disciplines. Don't just read IR. Don't just read history. I'm actually, for my sort of serious, impressive, this is how I scare you, that I'm really policy intellectual reading, I'm reading some political philosophy, Honora O'Neill's Bounds of Justice, which is a set of essays about thinking about justice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's fairly heavy going after a day of reading Twitter. But it's good for the soul. And then in addition to reading across categories, you know, we tend to be such a wonky group of people. For God's sake, read literature, read poetry, read the sports pages, read something that reminds you that this is all about human beings.
Yeah, although, with politicians, I don't have that worry that they're going to forget that. No, I really don't. They're going to read the sports pages no matter what. It's interesting that you said, you know, read people you disagree with and so forth. I have to say, Kissinger's diplomacy was one of the more popular suggestions in the comment thread, which I think is fair. You know, it's an accessible book.
I have a bad attitude toward that because I had to read it in college.
There you go.
But I think for exactly the reason that I had to read it in college, it's probably still a good idea.
Here would be I'll throw out five books that I think are, you know, useful, and in some ways actually mirroring things that you've said. And I actually haven't written this up as a blog post, so I've got to write this up later today. So
early
exactly
advantage,
this, yeah.
Blogging heads, viewers.
So, and in some ways, it's actually consistent with the things you said. The first is that I would I'd want to have books that, you know, to some extent, you know, tie in current thinking thoughts about foreign policy to American history, because that's what politicians actually like to read. They do like Americana. So, actually, my first book would be Walter Russell Meets Special Providence.
You know, I was thinking about that, and I have really mixed feelings about that book, because it's kind of like horoscopes.
It's kind of like,
but
say that again.
Given that successful American foreign policy involves picking and choosing across schools,
right.
I actually think that book stands as a useful introduction to the genre,
which
even if it is kind of like horoscopes.
Again, I mean, it's not what I would recommend, you know, at the advanced level, but again, we're talking about introductory people who don't know much about foreign policy but want to learn. I actually think that's an excellent first book, because it also shows the thing I want is that I want my guy at the end of whatever he's read to understand, oh, so there are different schools of thought about foreign policy, and so if their advisors start talking and they recognize what they're hearing as fitting in with a Jeffersonian or a Jacksonian or, you know, or a realist tradition, what have you. You know, so in other words, they've got the intellectual equipment after reading these books to be able to process them relatively well and process what the policy implications of them would be. So in that sense, Meet Special Providence, I think, works. Related to you, I also want them to read books about failure. So for Democrats, I would recommend Halberstam's Best and the Brightest. And for Republicans, I would recommend, I was actually, you know, Fiasco or James Mann's Rise of the Vulcans. And the point is, you got to read about your own party's failure. You can't read about the other party's failure. You're expecting that. So that would be important. I think Richard Neustadt and Ernie May's Thinking in Time is a good book. It's also about the ways in which, you know, policymakers come in and sort of assume that history doesn't matter and sort of forgets the ways in which and the mistakes that you can make by thinking that you're going to be able to come in with a fresh start and screw things up on your own. So that's actually a pretty good book. And related to that, this is the only academic-y book I would recommend, but Yu Fun Kong's Analogies at War, which I think is a great book about the ways in which policymakers, whenever they think about new situations, always think, well, this is like this situation that happened in the past, when of course it actually is not like the situation that happened in the past, and that creates problems. And I think the last book I would recommend, and this is really a placeholder, I need to see if there's a better one on this, but Andrew Kohut and Bruce Stokes' book about global public opinion.
Yep.
About the ways in which Americans think and the ways in which what American attitudes about foreign, you know, world politics are either is different with or consistent with what the rest of the world thinks. And I think one of their interesting and somewhat surprising conclusions is that, in fact, America is not an outlier on a lot of views about world politics. It's actually Europeans that are the outlier.
I'll mention as a postscript to that, although it's not comprehensive in the way that is, the Stephen Cull, the pollster who works out of the University of Maryland, has a new book coming out about sort of the origins of what's going on in the Arab world.
Oh, okay.
And how Muslims think about the world, which, as I say, it isn't a substitute for a global look at public opinion, but given current events, it's a pretty good addendum.
But these are excellent choices, and I know you need to get going. So, you know, we encourage our Blogging Heads listeners to offer their own suggestions in the comments and be as provocative as you possibly can.
Yeah, and we promise to pull some of them out and put them in our blogs. And Dan, it won't be 8 months before we do this again.
No, this is very much, much, much fun. We'll have to do this again. Maybe the next time a royal gets married or something, or gets divorced.
Okay, take care.
All right, take care. Bye.